We start off on January 24th with Dr. Martha Piper. This will be her introduction to the Vancouver audience, the new president of UBC. And then on the second Saturday after that, on February 1st, we have that new Vancouver author, Michael Harcourt. And then we have 11 speakers. We have on March 1st, we have Dr. Joseph Rotblat, who won last year's Nobel Peace Prize, who's going to talk about how to get rid of nuclear weapons. We have a number of exciting talks in medicine. Also, Simon Fraser University has again provided us with an outstanding lecture by Professor Peter Borwein, the Schrum professor, who's going to talk about mathematics and computers in early April. It's a very good season coming up, and so we think you should begin to anticipate it, and to do so, it's best to join today as you leave. Now, Alan Cairns really needs no introduction to this institute. There's hardly anyone who's better known to its audiences. He served as president, and then he was one of the very few presidents who actually received a recall notice, and he served again. He was better the second time. He's going to be talking today about a topic which is not only very important, but in which he is one of the country's outstanding analysts, the future of Canada. He's, since retiring from UBC a year and a half ago, he has been on the move. He is currently at Queen's University, he's been at Toronto, and he will spend the next calendar year at the University of Saskatchewan. And Alan will today speak to us about our country. We have to remember that the Vancouver Institute is 80 years old, Mrs. Lett is 100 years old, and Canada is 129 years old, but somewhat ailing. And so Alan is going to talk today to us about Canada. Can we survive? Professor Alan Cairns.
Thank you, Eric. I was afraid you were going to tell the audience how old I was, but fortunately I left that out of my briefing notes for you. I also like to thank Peter Nemetz for inviting me and for the noble work he has done for many years in organizing the program of the Vancouver Institute. Well, a couple of preliminary observations. 17 years ago, I spoke to the Vancouver Institute on the then view of our never-ending constitutional crisis. I talked on the Papin-Robarts report. 2 years ago, when I was president of the Institute, Angus Reid spoke to the Institute pretty well on the same subject. And in general, I think it's fair to say he was quite optimistic about the evolution of Quebec public opinion, believing that certain demographic factors were strengthening the no rather than the yes forces. And in between, I'm sure there have been other talks on our constitutional discontents. In my darker moments, I've sometimes wondered if the never-ending Canadian crisis is orchestrated by the program chairman of the Vancouver Institute. More consoling moment, so I'm reassured by a comment by a former colleague of mine, the late Diamond Smiley, who used to say that whatever bad things the constitutional crisis has done for Canada, it's been extremely good to political scientists. On the other hand, whether political scientists have been good to the constitutional crisis remains a question open for future examination. Now, by the survival of Canada, I'd like to be clear from the beginning. I don't actually mean the survival of Canada as it presently exists. I mean the survival of Canada if Quebec votes yes and if Quebec leaves. That is, what will happen to the rest of us if what we don't wish to happen does happen, and namely there is a decisive enough Quebec yes that we accept that. So the question to which I will try to give an answer, and I'll read the question, and then I'll play around with it a little bit because it sounds a little bit internally contradictory. My question is, how can we outside of Quebec prepare for the fact that we will be unprepared to respond intelligently to the reconstitution of rest of Canada should Quebec vote a convincing yes in the next referendum? So putting that in another language to make sure my question is clear to you, it's given the fact that, as I shall try to demonstrate in my talk, that we will really be almost completely unprepared, if Quebec votes yes, to respond to our own condition. That is, how would we like to live as a separate people after Quebec has gone? How can we get ready for the fact that we will be completely unready? Well, I think to get into this, I have to make a few observations on what has come to be known as Track 1 and Track 2, or Plan A and Plan B. Now, Plan A, as you all know, is really the renewal of Canada focus, and we can say that this is a focus, a theme, an orientation which has been in existence in the contemporary period, at least since the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism. That commission, which, as you recall, in 1965, said Canada was in a state of crisis. Now, Plan A then follows through in various transformations up to the Charlottetown Accord, and with many stopping points in between. But up until the recent Quebec referendum, really, Canadians outside of Quebec essentially only had a Plan A. We did not have a Plan B or a Track 2. And Plan B, the territory that it has come to try to encompass, is what should we do if Quebec votes yes? That is, instead of concentrating all our efforts in trying to prevent Quebec from voting yes, efforts which still continue in Plan A, we ask ourselves a supplementary question: how can we prepare ourselves for the outcome that we do not wish? Now, formerly, Plan B was taboo territory. That is, we were not supposed to discuss Plan B on the ground that to discuss Plan B, by which was meant how the rest of us, to repeat, will respond to a Quebec yes, we were not supposed to respond to that because it was assumed that that meant we were indicating a high probability that the yes forces would win, and thus we were facilitating the yes forces in Quebec by letting them know that we thought the momentum was on their side. So up until very recently, to operate in Plan B territory was a no-no. That is no longer the case. One of the most important transformations in our constitutional public discourse is that Plan B is now vigorously discussed, although one could not argue that there is a coherent program which occupies the territory which Plan B logically should encompass. So Plan B, from a taboo topic, has become a topic that is now actively pursued and considered by Canadians and their governments. Well, why has this area moved from out of the let's not talk about it category to one where significant concentration is now focused on it? Well, there are two essential reasons. The first reason is the regrettable but undeniable record of the failures of constitutional reform that have been undertaken by this country really since the 1980-82 period, culminating in the Constitution Act of 1982. Although that act was, in one sense, a success, it was not a complete success because, as you will recall, the government of Quebec refused to sign on, as the phrase went, and later turned their non-participation into the great betrayal. And all subsequent efforts have failed to produce a result which could be implemented, and we now tend to think of the amending formula as a formula which is almost unworkable. And so we, in a sense, are saying the Plan A territory is territory which we're less and less optimistic that we can successfully operate in. And secondly, there is the decisive psychological impact, I think, on the way we view our future of the October 30th, 1980 referendum result. Charles Taylor, the distinguished Quebec philosopher, in discussing the impact of the failure of Meech Lake on the Quebec population, said that something snapped in Quebec after the defeat of Meech Lake, by which he meant that when the population of Quebec became aware that what they viewed as a modest package of constitutional change could not get through the system, something snapped, i.e. a recognition that it would be almost impossible for them to achieve the kind of renewal of federalism that the Federalists thought was desirable. Well, I would argue that after the October 30th referendum in Quebec, something snapped outside of Quebec. we realized that we, too, lived in a different world. And our different world was a world in which we had to begin to accept the possibility that maybe this country might not survive. Before I get to the particulars of the kind of intellectual conundrum that we find ourselves in as a result of this new recognition of our realities, I'd like to take you through three asides. If there are lawyers in the audience, we could say three obiter dicta. Firstly, and a point which tends to be overlooked, surprisingly, because it is extremely obvious, and that is that Quebec has had both a Plan A and a Plan B for decades. That is, ever since the formation of the Parti Québécois in 1968, to take an obvious starting point, Quebec has always had one set of social forces in that province, and one political party which aimed for the renewal of federalism, and another political party which aimed for some version of the breakup of Canada under various titles, sovereignty association, being the most recent one. So Quebec has always, for the last 30 years, operated on two fronts at the same time, and it has vigorous actors in both arenas simultaneously. So in that sense, when we now say we too are going to operate in Plan B, we are simply catching up to what they have been doing all along. Now, a second point that is extremely important in thinking of the difficulty that we are having in responding to the very, very problematic situation that we find ourselves in is that Plan B, that is the response of Canadians outside Quebec to how they might respond to a yes vote in Quebec, that tends to divide the Federalist forces in Quebec from the Federalist forces outside Quebec. And you will notice that if you simply are a kind of ordinary daily reader of the Globe and Mail. Because what Plan B does is Plan B tells the citizens of Quebec that the rest of Canada is thinking of an outcome in which the Federalist forces in Quebec will have lost. And they will have lost in a way much more decisively than the Federalist forces outside Quebec, because the Federalist forces outside Quebec have another country, now called rest of Canada, to retreat to. So Plan B, which is the plan which includes Chrétien saying there's got to be a clear question, Chrétien saying maybe 50% plus one is not enough, Stéphane Dion saying maybe we'll have to consider, or maybe the partition of Quebec might be an item on the agenda, and the Department of Justice submitting a reference question to the Supreme Court asking what the legality is in terms of both domestic and international law of a Quebec unilateral declaration of independence. So these are all questions which are much more relevant to Federalist forces outside Quebec than Federalist forces inside Quebec, and thus there is tension now between Mr. Johnson and the Federalist actors in Ottawa and elsewhere in the country. The third aside I'd like to draw your attention to is the difficulty we are having of playing both games at once. Now, it's worth noting that it's easier for both games to be played simultaneously in Quebec than it is outside Quebec. And the reason for that is, in Quebec, two parties play the game. One party plays the Plan A game, i.e. the renewal of federalism in Quebec, and a different party plays the sovereignty association game, the breakup Canada game, possibly followed by various kinds of partnership links. So the fact they're separate actors means that in one way they don't get in each other's way. But for the rest of us, we have one actor. Since the federal government is the leader in this enterprise, the federal government has to play both games at the same time. And that's difficult for a whole lot of reasons. First of all, it's psychologically difficult, because each game requires a different view of the person to whom the game is directed. The Plan A, the renewal of federalism game, is directed to our fellow citizens in Quebec. The Plan B, the response to a Quebec yes, is devoted to those future foreign citizens in a neighboring country that are no longer part of our community. People that we think of when we project ourselves into that future situation as those who will have broken up our country. So we relate to the Quebec population in a very different fashion depending on whether we're thinking of Plan A, i.e. fellow citizens, citizens, or Plan B, you have destroyed our country, and it's psychologically difficult. I realize the federal government is not a single homogeneous actor, but nevertheless, it's difficult even for a kind of multiple actors such as that simultaneously to keep both of these definitions of the situation in play and play both of them equally vigorously at the same time. In addition, it is difficult to play Plan A and Plan B simultaneously from outside Quebec because you give a lot of weapons to your opponents. That is, the sovereigntists in Quebec in particular can say that you only pretend to be playing the renewal of federal game seriously because we observe that simultaneously you are preparing for the breakup of this country. Well, moving on. If you were to think that because Plan B now exists, that the territory that logically should be encompassed within kind of all the main facets of our response to the breakup of this country and the independence of Quebec, you would probably think that one of the items that should be included in that large Plan B territory will be the preparation of the rest of us for an independent future after Quebec has gone. In other words, that there should be, you might think, if you're thinking logically, a preparation for the reconstitution of a Canada that does not include Quebec. And what we will find in this talk is that, of course, Plan B does not include at all any attention to the reconstitution of Canada without Quebec. That is, it pays no attention to how we might survive the departure of Quebec. Why is this so? The federal government both won't and can't do it. You notice that what the federal government mainly does in what we have now come to call Plan B is a series of proposals which are telling Quebecers that if they go the risky route of independence, they are getting into very, very dangerous territory because we on the other side of the table are going to be tough bargainers, we're not going to be pushovers, we're going to insist that Quebecers take their full share of the debt, we're going to require a fair question, we might pose the issue of the partition of Quebec and so on. So when you really look at Plan B closely as it emerges outside of Quebec, you find that it very frequently is an indirect attempt to reinforce the no side in Quebec by talking about the high costs that the attempted independence of Quebec, especially by UDI, would bring in its wake. Well, to focus on the reconstitution of the rest of Canada carries no threat to Quebec. In fact, it does the reverse. It tells them that we are getting ready for the outcome that the sovereigntist forces are seeking. So that's one reason the federal government won't or cannot act in this territory. But in addition to this, there's another more fundamental sort of structural or logical reason. The federal government cannot begin to prepare for a future for rest of Canada, for Canada without Quebec, because it is not the government of the rest of Canada. The federal government is now and will be until midnight, that is, until the Quebec departure becomes ultimate, whether by UDI or formal amending formula. Until that point, the Quebec government is the government of Canada. So it cannot make, in particular, public preparations for a future from which Quebec is excluded. And psychologically, the federal government will not plan for its own defeat, because to vigorously talk about and publicly try to educate Canadians in their future without Quebec is to anticipate that the battle has been lost. So the federal government is not going to be a key educator of the rest of us in the future we might have to try to work out should Quebec leave. And the provinces will do very, very little, and whatever they will be backroom, and therefore will be a particularistic provincial perspective, and will not educate their citizens in how those citizens should respond should the country break up. The reality then is that if Canada is to break up after a yes referendum vote in Quebec, there will be an almost total lack of preparation by those of us outside Quebec, including governments and citizens, for this devastating reality. And in thinking about our dramatic lack of preparedness, It's useful to contrast our situation of that hypothetical future moment with how it will look like, with how it will look within Quebec. Now, I don't wish to give the impression that I believe that the socio-political economic reality in Quebec will be, in any sense, peaceful, in any sense, an easy situation for the then government of Quebec to handle. In fact, I think Quebec will be a profoundly, deeply divided society, you know, and one has a suspicion that it might be quite difficult to even maintain law and order. Having said that, there will remain a fundamental distinction between the emergence of this outcome, i.e. Quebec leaving Canada, distinction between how they will be ready for it and how we will not be. For example, Quebecers have been socialized emotionally and intellectually into this as a desirable outcome for 30 or 40 years. When it happens, it will have happened as a result of a referendum which presumably will have mobilized, you know, 60% plus of the Francophone population. So they will be moving to a future which they will feel they have chosen, for which they have become emotionally and intellectually prepared, at least to some extent. In addition to that, the Quebec population will enter this new future with what we could call institutional framework continuity, by which I simply mean that the Quebec government, now the government of a province, will fairly quickly and easily, in terms of its perception as being the actor in charge, simply become the government of an independent Quebec. And thirdly, Quebecers will experience this outcome, at least the majority that was in favor, with a sense of pride, a sense of joy, a sense of exhilaration about that nationalist goal that the pure sovereigntists, at least, have been seeking, has finally been achieved. So let us contrast the rest of us with those three realities. Will we have been emotionally and intellectually prepared to occupy, to inhabit, to live in this new country from which Quebec has gone? No, there will be almost negligible, there will be negligible preparation. Can we guarantee institutional continuity? Well, we don't know. We don't know whether Canada without Quebec will survive as a single entity, and I'll go on to discuss that in a moment. Will we be proud? Will we think this is an achievement? No. We will be resentful. We will be bitter. We will feel wounded. We will feel the country that we wanted to keep together has been taken from us. So in every one of these three, in a sense, orientations, Quebec and its population is in a much more privileged situation with respect to their future than we will be with respect to our future. So there is therefore a crucial difference between the two Plan Bs. Quebec's Plan B is a sovereignty option. Canada's Plan B is not a sovereignty option for the rest of Canada. It is rather a response to the possibility of Quebec sovereignty and therefore to the bargaining that will follow. So desirable as it is, it does not cover a very important part of the large bag of questions that we will have to grapple with at that time. Well, you might say that's not too important because what will happen to the rest of us is, so to speak, fairly predictable. It's in the nature of things. That is, there are social forces, there are institutional factors, which means that the outcome of Quebec leaves is, in a sense, fairly easy to understand if you have a good sort of theoretical sense of how institutions and societies interact with each other. And therefore, you might say, if that were to be the case, our lack of preparation for it doesn't really matter because the preparation, in a sense, could be compensated for by the fact that it's going to work out in a particular way because there is no other alternative. Well, if you look at the literature, what you find is those who try to discern the future of Canada without Quebec are literally all over the map. First of all, there is a group that we could call the breakup group. That is, those who feel that Canada without Quebec will not survive as a single actor. This includes John Crosby. This includes Robert Bourassa. This includes Charles Doran, who gave a recent, published a recent paper in the prestigious American Journal of Foreign Affairs. It includes a number of well-established academics, such as Peter Leslie of Queen's University. So there's a significant group of knowledgeable people who feel that those of us outside Quebec will not hang together as a single country after Quebec leaves. On the other hand, there is another group, and that includes Philip Resnick of this university, it includes Maureen Covell of Simon Fraser University, it includes a number of other people, the names of which may not be well known to a non-political science audience, but who do feel that Canadians outside Quebec will more or less continue with suitable modifications of the institutional structure they have inherited, but that we will not fragment. And in fact, the most important and impressive analysis of the future of Canada without Quebec by the University of Western Ontario political scientist Robert Young is quite categorical that we outside of Quebec will survive as a single actor. Nevertheless, even those who think we will remain together admit that breakup is a very serious possibility. Thus, we might say the optimists contain behind their facade of optimism a deep grain of pessimism. They're not sure we'll pull it off. They think we will, but they're not sure. In addition to which, those who look at the future of Canada without Quebec and think we will stay together, they disagree on the kind of Canada without Quebec that will survive. For example, just taking two choices, Gordon Gibson, our local constitutional commentator, believes that Canada without Quebec will be a very, very decentralized country. And in some of his writings, of course, he's not even clear that we will survive as a single country. By contrast, there's a very distinguished political economist at Queen's University who feels that we will not only survive, but we will virtually move towards a unitary state. Now, this is the economist Don Escher, and he believes this because he thinks that the only factor which makes us federal, the only significant factor that makes us federal, is the presence of Quebec, and when Quebec goes, the natural forces of unification will push us all towards what he really calls a unitary state in which the provinces will have disappeared. Now, as a general proposition, what we could call the survivalists, that is, those who think we will continue as a single country, they tend to stress what I would call sociological or cultural or identity factors. They, in other words, say that beneath the federal divisions of those of us outside Quebec, we really are one people. We are knit by common values. We have the psychological attraction of the Charter, which gives us a common instrument with which we identify. We share a common history. We are proud of the Canada from which Quebec is left. And therefore, we will remain a single country. The breakuppers, or the massive decentralizers, by contrast, they stress when they say we will not survive or we will be profoundly decentralized. They don't talk of sociological or psychological or identity factors. They tend to talk of institutional factors. And they stress two phenomena. They stress, firstly, what they see will be the shattering defeat of the central government, which will be prostrate after Quebec leaves, on the ground that the central government will have failed in the fundamental raison d'etre of any government of a country. It's primary task of keeping the country together. And in addition to that, there will be the incredible sort of restructuring of the central government will be required, because it is the central government, we must remember, that loses territory, that loses population, and of course will lose ministers. It will have to be refashioned in terms of the governing party and so on. Whereas the provincial governments, by contrast, do not experience that sort of shattering institutional blow to their identity at all. They're still here in exactly the same way they were before. So the decentralizers, or the breakuppers, say that when the battle to refashion us takes place, the actors that will be powerful at the table will be the provinces, not the central government. And when they say the provinces, they mean Alberta, British Columbia, and Ontario. So they tend to provide an institutional explanation. for why we will not remain together. And by inference, they're suggesting that the underlying sociological unity, which the optimists say will keep us together, is insufficiently deeply rooted to overcome these institutional pressures towards fragmentation. Well, what is my conclusion to all of this? The main conclusion is that we do not know at all what will happen to the rest of Canada after a yes. Because those who have most vigorously tried to examine the situation are in profound disagreement. Now you could say, well, what does Cairns think? But that's not the issue. My point is that when we look at all those who have tried to figure it out, they give very, very different answers. So the reality is that we don't know what will happen. And that's a very profoundly important statement. It means that when we confront this situation, if it happens, I mean, I'm operating on the basis of a hypothesis, of course, that Quebec has voted yes. If we confront this situation, as we move towards it, we will be moving into an area in which the most central sort of thing we see in our future vision is a huge question mark. So we have to prepare for the fact that we will be completely ignorant of how the post-yes scenario for the rest of us is going to evolve. And my second point is that it is impossible for us to prepare in advance for this reality. Because, as I've already indicated, governments will not and cannot prepare for this reality. And so, although there will be some preparation by think tanks, and we will probably, by that time it happens, if it does happen, have a fairly impressive couple of shelves of books and articles by academics looking at the issue, this is not really preparation. This is not the preparation of a people and their governments for the breakup of a country. This is a useful bit of intellectual capital that will be available when that event takes place, if it does, but it is not preparing governments and people for the outcome. So we will, even when we say we will be completely ignorant, some will say, well, why don't we do something about it? And I'm saying we can't, and we won't, and we will therefore end up with this question mark confronting us. And my final conclusion then of this part of my paper is that following a definitive yes, there will be massive uncertainty outside Quebec, inside Quebec too, but that's not my focus. There will be fear, there will be panic, there will be anger. And in particular, the public will be almost completely unprepared for this outcome. And this then becomes a very, very volatile, a very, very dangerous situation. It is a situation that is ripe for demagogues. So, what should we do, given that this is the future, or one of the two futures, into which we might be moving if the other future is that we stay together, either because the status quo survives or Canada somehow or other gets a renewed federal system. So, what are we to do? Well, in a way, what I'm about to suggest sounds rather trite. Some things that are trite are important and profound. Some things that are trite are trite. My suggestion is that we continue for an interim 3 to 5 year period with the existing constitutional structure without Quebec. That we just excise Quebec in all the areas from which they have to be taken out, Supreme Court, House of Commons, Parliament, all the boards and commissions, and all the legislation which is aimed at Quebec, and then we carry on for this interim period, and in that interim period, we then attend to the reconstitution of the rest of Canada, because that's my focus. It is the reconstitution of the rest of Canada. How do we and when do we actually think of what kind of people we wish to become if Quebec leaves? Now, it's important to keep in mind what I'm not discussing. I am not discussing the immediate post-yes bargaining situation with Quebec. I'm discussing the situation after Quebec has gone. The bargaining situation is itself sufficiently complicated, that would require another and a very, very different lecture. Well, why should we opt for this stratagem that I'm suggesting? That is that we continue with the existing constitutional structure with Quebec gone. What are the more elaborate number of reasons for delay that one can list? Well, first of all, I think it will be tremendously psychologically reassuring to Canadians to know that the country without Quebec is going to carry on. It's going to carry on for some transitional period. And in that transitional period, we're going to figure out how we wish to carry on after the transitional period is over. It also seems to me that the knowledge and the reality that we're going to carry on will be reassuring to the other international actors, the other states in the international system, and to the international financial community, i.e. a tremendous body blow has struck at and wounded Canada, but the old order is still there, bloody but unbowed, one might say. Secondly, it does seem to me that there is a very profound psychological and intellectual difficulty in thinking about the future of Canada while Quebec remains. That is, even if one could argue that it would be possible for governments and peoples to engage in a massive kind of public education program to prepare for the possibility that Quebec might leave, so that we would be ready if that event were to happen, it just seems to me that it would be extraordinarily difficult for intellectual and emotional reasons to do so, because that is not an outcome that we seek. And it's very difficult, it seems to me, for us to give up on the vision of a Canada that includes Quebec and concentrate wholeheartedly and positively on a vision of Canada that excludes Quebec, whilst it's still, we hope, possible to retain Quebec within Canada. In other words, I think that the serious thinking of a Canada without Quebec cannot take place until Quebec has left Canada. That the breakup of the old paradigm is a psychological prerequisite for examining a new paradigm in which the hole between Ontario and New Brunswick is not just something we conjure up against the reality of the still existing map in which Quebec is there, but in which that vacancy in our middle is real. Quebec really is not there, and then there's a kind of reality shock which will force us to think fundamentally and seriously about an issue that I'm saying it would be almost impossible for us to think about prior to that event. And thirdly, unless we agree to continue, unless we agree to delay our reconstitution, our thinking will be driven, I fear, by panic, by insecurity, by lack of preparation, and by a kind of frantic search for quick security. And in those circumstances, the danger, as I see it, is that the most available option will simply carry the day, because people will want the knowledge that there is something onto which they can cling in this crisis situation. So to move quickly, given, if you accept my argument that we will be unprepared, to move quickly is almost a guarantee that we will be decisively influenced by ephemeral factors. And there are many ephemeral factors and many scenarios that we could examine. Let me just look at two scenarios. The one is the one that the breakupers or the massive decentralizers envisaged. That is the one which says that after Quebec goes, the shock of Quebec's departure will leave us with a ravaged central government, weakened, prostrate, incapable of playing the leadership role, and confronting that weakened central government at the time of our reconstitution, if we try to act quickly, we will have a rampant provincialism, particularly led, as I've already said, by the big three, Ontario, Alberta, and British Columbia, and the reality, if we stay together at all, will be a profoundly decentralized Canada responding to the momentum and the inertia of those particular forces which by accident happen to occupy the stage. Or one might visualize an alternative scenario. And that is that the breakup of Quebec, or the breakup of Canada, with Quebec leaving, induces a powerful surge of loyalty towards an identification with the central government, on the ground that that is the government to which Canadians would automatically direct their search for security, because it's the one which is, in a sense, responsible for law and order, responsible for our safety in an interdependent world. And that it is possible that the central government, in that circumstance, might act very decisively, but that central government might very successfully and in our self-interest handle the bargaining process with Quebec, and we might then come out of that immediate post-yes situation with a lot of very positive attitudes to the central government for having handled a very difficult situation with tremendous aplomb and success. And if that is the case, and if we reconstitute in the light of that context, then of course we may end up being much more centralized, because the government that in our immediate past will have played such a strong and effective role will be Ottawa, and they, being composed of politicians like the provincial governments are, will use that triumph to push a reconstituted Canada, this hypothesis would suggest, in a centralist direction. Now, my perspective is that I'm opposed not to either of those outcomes as such. I prefer one rather than the other, but I am opposed to the possibility that who we become after Quebec leaves is decisively influenced by the accident of the manner of our breakup. It does not seem to me to be reasonable that the kind of country we should become should be overwhelmingly influenced by the unpredictable, fortuitous events that attend that departure, in which order of government happens to seize the role, or seize some kind of leadership role, and attract our identification with that. So I do not wish our post-Quebec constitution to make us one thing or the other thing, so to speak, by the accident of how we happen to break up. So my argument is that we must delay. We must delay till we can get some kind of level playing field, until the dust has settled, until the anger, and there will be a great deal of anger outside of Quebec, until that anger to some extent has been left behind. But most importantly, to delay so that we can give a chance for reason, we can give a chance for clarity, we can give a chance to discussion, to educate us for the kind of future that we will not have been educated for prior to the breakup. In other words, I am saying that we have to do after the country breaks up what Quebecers will have been doing for 30 years prior to the breakup of the country from their perspective. An additional reason for delay is that delay will give us more information about our international environment. We will be in the atypical situation for Canadians that we will have two foreign neighbors on our borders for the first time. We will have an independent Quebec, and we must remember Quebec becomes foreign, Quebec becomes an independent state. We do no longer treat Quebec with a kind of empathy and sympathy and feeling of belonging to the same community that applies when they are part of the country. They become a foreign country and will be treated entirely in the light of our self-interest when that occurs. If we delay, we will have more knowledge of what that actor is like. We will have had more time to adjust to the reality of the international context of our independence. Well, the largest reason, of course, for delay, really to summarize all of this, is that we will confront an incredibly momentous task. Our task will be to create a new country. It will be to create a new people. And I am saying, since we will not be ready to do that at the time of breakup, we should give ourselves time to do it thoroughly and intelligently, and in a way which involves citizens and governments in a profoundly difficult but important educational process. Well, I would be less than honest if I did not conclude by also noting that there are very significant disadvantages to delay. So let me underline some of these disadvantages. I will try not to make them so disadvantageous that they will overthrow my main thesis, but I will draw them to your attention enough that you will say, well, there's an honest academic. Clearly, the transition period will be very stressful. The main stress will be because the transitional structure that I'm suggesting should continue, which is the old Canada without Quebec, that is, there'll be the same parliament without Quebec members, the same Supreme Court, the same Charter of Rights, the same 9 provinces and 2 territories, the same laws and legislations, that is, they will all continue, but clearly there will be a kind of limited legitimacy to that continuing structure, to those continuing policies, because we will know that we are in a transition period. We will know that simultaneous to that ongoingness, there will be another process taking place in which we are trying to figure out who we wish to be. And to the extent that the discussions and arguments and future projections of who we will be in that other process differ significantly from the old structure, then by definition they're making that old structure look more and more illegitimate. So the old structure will be there, but it will be kind of hollow, especially if it looks, to repeat, that we're going to reconstitute ourselves in a way fairly different from that old structure. So there will be a kind of ambiguous period in which the old is still there and it's turning over, so to speak, but the new is being born beside it, and that will make the old look like less and less of an actor in which we're putting our hopes and capable of acting decisively. It strikes me that very few major policy initiatives will be possible for that transitional government, for the obvious reason that it cannot bind a future when we do not know what that future is going to be. So it will be a kind of holding operation. The old policies will be there, except for those that have to be decisively modified to respond to the departure of Quebec, but we will not undertake significant new policies, except for ones to deal with the crisis situation that we will be in. It also means, whether this is a disadvantage or an advantage, I don't know, but it also means that this transitional situation will limit the response we are able to make to Quebec until we figure out who we are. That is, there will be certain inescapable arrangements that we will have to make with Quebec just because of the ongoingness of our coexistence on the northern half of this continent. But any suggestion by Quebec for, and now we're speaking of an independent Quebec, for arrangements that speak in terms of partnership and as jointly operating, you know, institutions in whatever area they wish to include in their association side, will be ones that it seems to me will be almost bound to reject and saying, we cannot respond to that now because we do not know who we are going to be. We may not even end up being one actor. And therefore, we cannot enter into these arrangements until we've sorted out our own identity problems. So we're sorry, you may have thought that all of this was going to be very easy for you to get us to bargain on those issues and also to come to terms, which would be mutually advantageous, but we're telling you that we will not be ready, and you will simply have to wait until we are ready. Another policy area in which delay, it seems to me, is almost unavoidable, is there will be a delay in responding to the recently issued report of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, to the extent that the response, in a sense, is still in process of being worked out at the time this hypothetical event I'm discussing, the departure of Quebec, takes place. Because again, we cannot make decisions about the relationship between Aboriginal nations and the rest of us when we don't know who the we is into which those Aboriginal nations are to fit and with whom they are to live. So this too will, to some extent, get put on the back burner. On the other hand, to the extent that the Royal Commission report appears to Aboriginal peoples to offer to them a very desirable definition of their future, they, in a way, will come to the reconstitution bargaining table with probably, I haven't read the report, probably a very effectively worked out set of propositions about what they would like to get from this new Canada that we hope will be emerging. Also, in this period, there will be federal and provincial elections, and they, in a sense, will be, it could not be otherwise, they will be destabilizing, because they will focus on the Constitution. It's impossible to visualize of elections taking place in a transitional crisis situation such as this, in which the competing parties do not debate with each other about the contending futures or alternative futures that they are trying to get their supporters to line up behind and to vote for them. So this too will be destabilizing, but it's a kind of necessary destabilization. It is part of our education, our necessary education, in this new situation in which we will finding ourselves. Well, this is probably the most obvious question that will be asked of someone who makes the kind of proposal that I am making, that we have this transitional continuity. The question will be, am I either unconsciously or slyly, subtly, trying to privilege the status quo? Am I trying to privilege the center? Am I trying to give the federal government an advantage in that reconstitution scenario that I am saying we otherwise will be unprepared for? Well, I think my answer to that would honestly be not necessarily, because it depends on which post-yes scenario evolves. If the post-yes scenario is one in which the central government manages to attract the loyalty and identification of Canadians in this crisis period and brilliantly handles the bargaining situation with Quebec and appears to have triumphed on behalf of this smaller group of Canadian people, and I'm saying, no, let us delay, let us not reconstitute ourselves now, then I clearly am not serving the federal government. I'm saying I want the dust to settle, and therefore the provincial governments probably would be stronger actors down the road than they would if that were the scenario that were to triumph. On the other hand, if the other scenario were to triumph and the provinces were the chief actors, one then clearly could argue that my scenario is designed to allow time for the central government to reestablish itself and for the events of the breakup to be somewhat forgotten and for the confrontation between rival visions to take place between actors who have, in a sense, operate on the level playing field that this transition period is designed to produce. I do think the one outcome that it, I would hope, precludes is it minimizes or works against the possibility that we will not survive as a single people. And the reason it works against that possibility is that it precludes a provincial takeover of the reconstitution agenda at a time when the federal government might be prostrate and very weak, and in which the provincial governments appear to be the only significant and powerful actors. And in that circumstances, particularly the big three again, might act in terms of their own self-interest. And I am saying, in fact, what I would be trying to do in this argument is to generate a premise that they would, and a belief that they would be acting unfairly if they were to take advantage of the situation when the other vision of the country, for temporary reasons, happens to be decisively weakened. So, my recommendation, therefore, is, and that is in response, as you recall, to my initial question, how do we prepare for the fact that we will be completely unprepared for this event, if it is to happen? My recommendation is that we continue with the old order, with Quebec gone for this transitional period of 3 to 5 years. And the purpose of doing this is to give us time to think about a new order as one or more peoples, and to set in motion a reconstitution process which will allow us rationally with reasonable time to improve our understanding of a new situation, to decide who we wish to be if what we don't wish to happen happens. And it would be helpful if this understanding that we will continue as we are without Quebec could be a widely disseminated understanding before a yes vote. In particular, therefore, it would be very helpful if some leading politicians and government actors would say, that is the way we view the future of Canada without Quebec for this transitional period. It strikes me that that would be an immensely reassuring kind of statement to come from our political leaders. And for those of you who say, well, that is not a happy scenario, in general that I portrayed, all I can say are several things. Don't shoot the messenger, but also, do you have a better alternative? I don't. Thank you.
We'll have a usual question period. Questions, of course, not comments, is what we welcome. Yes, Robert.
I'd like, Alan, to ask you this. Accepting what you said, totally, loving as you do this country and wanting to stay it together, what should we as individuals do in the next 3 years ourselves? Not our political parties, but we as individuals.
You want to repeat the question?
Professor Clark said, loving the country as we all do, what should we do in the next 3 or 4 years as individuals accepting the way I've portrayed this future unfolding? Well, I guess one of the things I would do is saying we should not neglect Plan A, because this scenario only develops if Plan A doesn't produce a kind of renewed federalism which keeps the country together. So I would say we have to try to renew our faith in the possibility of some kind of constitutional process which will produce a package of changes acceptable to the soft nationalists in Quebec. I guess my only other point would be, I do think that the build-up of intellectual capital about alternative ways of thinking about a post-yes situation for the rest of us is very valuable. I don't argue that it will prepare governments and citizens for that future, but it is better to have a big shelf of analyses by academics on alternative futures than to have no shelf. So it's good to have an intellectual body of material ready when that time comes that can be tapped into for a quick kind of educational fix on the situation, which, however, will look different after a yes than it looks by those who are writing in advance of a yes. And I guess my third observation would be you should tell them that the proposals that Alan Cairns puts forth sounds very reasonable to you, and that they should. But we academics can only throw our opinions out to the public.
Back there and then here.
The balkanization of the world seems to benefit maybe the Conrad Labs and the Murdochs of the world and the global corporations who control most of its wealth. If we don't deal with that aspect, balkanization, wherever it occurs in the world, why would it be any different after breakup?
So I'm not sure I heard the last part of that.
He said, why would it be any different after the breakup?
Well, it won't be any different.
The economic walls are leading to balkanization of many countries in the world.
Yeah.
Increasing injustice, higher unemployment.
Clearly there are...
Repeat the question.
The question is, and I'm not sure I entirely understood it, but there's a whole lot of terrible problems, globalization, the power of multinational corporations, very high unemployment, fragmenting processes in a number of countries. How does that fit into your scenario? And I didn't deal with those questions. To which I answer, of course, I didn't deal with those questions. I didn't intend to deal with those questions. I intended to deal with a different question. I do, however, think that all of the concerns you have will be worsened if that scenario does develop of the breakup of Canada, because presumably, at least for some transitional period, that will make us all weaker actors confronting these forces that you would like us, to be able to control and to modify in the interest of higher employment, better standards of living, and so on. So, in general, I don't try to defend myself against aspects of the world I didn't cover in a talk which wasn't intended to do so.
We have had one over here, and then we have Mrs. Lefter.
My question is, no country can survive my understanding, no country can survive unless its people has a sense of citizenship. Now, what can people do right now? Government and having dual citizenship is a contributor to a nothing Canada. So, can you comment on specific things like the Canadian government acting as though it really cares about the citizens of Canada and making, helping them be strong and productive as citizens of Canada?
The question.
In other words, the federal government now could act for Canada.
Well, the question is that, of course, a sense of citizenship is absolutely crucial to the survival of a country, particularly a democratic country in which the citizens feel they're important participants and players, and the country exists for them, not just for elites or for corporations. That, amongst other things, a dual sense of citizenship militates against that positive sense of sense unilateral belonging to the particular state in which we happen to live. What can and should the central government do? Well, I understand that there are committee proceedings taking place at the moment which are looking at the issue of dual citizenship, and there is a possibility that dual citizenship might not be allowed in the future. The federal government has made it fairly clear that in the event of Quebec leaving, the possibility of dual citizenship with Quebecers holding Canadian and Quebec citizenship will not be allowed by Canadians outside Quebec. The other aspect, I guess, is that the way governments induce strong feelings of loyalty and identification amongst their citizens is by doing a good job, by running their affairs intelligently, economically, and by producing the kind of benefits that we think is appropriate, but also by asking us to be significant participants in working out our common future. I guess one would argue that this Canadian sense of citizenship in a lot of ways has been tremendously reinforced and strengthened in the last 15 or 20 years. And the Charter of Rights has been an instrument which has given a lot of Canadians a much more positive feeling of identification with the constitutional order because of their rights than existed prior to 1982. So I don't think our government is doing a terribly bad job in that difficult way in the kind of world in which we live and retaining and generating a strong sense of attraction to the political order amongst its citizens. Even in Quebec, there's a widespread desire to continue in some kind of positive relationship with this Canada that, from another perspective, they're planning to leave.
Mrs. Lett.
I'm sorry I can't stand up for
you. It's okay.
I wanted to ask the speaker if he had already thrown in the towel.
Ask the question.
Has the speaker already thrown in the towel? When the speaker gets asked a question like that, he wishes he had a towel to wipe his perspiring forehead. The answer is categorically no. The answer is that the result of the October 30th referendum made it absolutely foolish for the rest of us to pay no attention to the possibility this country might break up. That would be an act of irresponsibility, given the closeness of that outcome. And that, therefore, we have to operate in this Plan B territory. And I'm arguing that some aspects of Plan B are ones, even though logically we should act in, we won't and can't. And so I'm sort of proposing a backup proposal to compensate for inability to act vigorously in this part of Plan B. Have I given up? No, I already said in answer to one question that I really thought one message in answer to Robert Clark was that we should make sure that in thinking about Plan B we do not neglect the tremendous importance of Plan A, because that is what will prevent the breakup of the country from happening if we can get some kind of package that will keep us together. If you say, am I pessimistic? Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, I'm pessimistic. Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, I'm a little optimistic. So on the whole, I think we're in a very, very difficult situation. I haven't thrown in the towel, but I think it would be foolish not to get ready for the possibility that we might not win a game no matter how well we play it.
Over here?
Well, I understand some of your reasons for delaying any decisions regarding Canada from 3 to 5 years in the event that Quebec does separate. If I can rephrase the question that came back, that came from the top there,
yeah.
In light of globalization, in light of what some people say is the decline of the nation state vis-a-vis the city state, will not the increasing pace of changes in the world make our constitutional arrangements more or less irrelevant as money crosses borders, etc.?
Repeat the question.
The question really is, given a whole lot of globalizing tendencies and accepting the logic of why I'm arguing that it would be sensible from one perspective to delay for 3 to 5 years, the question more or less suggests, will it not be irrelevant in a globalizing world? Will not whatever constitutional arrangements we have in a globalizing world be irrelevant? Well, I don't think the nation state is quite that much, on the rocks, as your question suggests. It's still the most important concentration of political power, legitimacy, and authority that we have. One reason for delay, I would argue, is that delay will allow us to reconstitute in a sense that might facilitate a more appropriate response to those globalizing forces. Our existing constitution largely comes from the middle of the 19th century, and one might think if we were devising a constitution for the 21st century, given those forces you talk about, we would do something different. And therefore, if we take time to do something different, we might end up with a greater degree of control over admittedly a very difficult set of forces impinging on the nation state than is the case if we act quickly or just say the old order is appropriate. And even a slight margin of leverage on these situations you describe is terribly important for us to try to achieve.
Back there.
You mentioned the two players, Quebec and the rest of Canada. Where would you fit in the Aboriginal population, the Native Indians?
Well, it seems to me, the question was, I seem to have postulated the discussion in terms of two players, Quebec and the rest of Canada, where would I fit in the Aboriginal peoples? Well, I've indicated that I think it will be difficult for us to respond within this transitional framework that I'm hypothesizing we should accept, difficult to respond within that to the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, and that will be one of the main policy areas along with various responses to Quebec that will have to be held up. But from a different perspective, the Aboriginal peoples in the reconstitution process will, in a sense, have a ready-made package of constitutional proposals emanating from that Royal Commission, which they can bring to a bargaining table, in which I am assuming there will be significant players, as there were in the Charlottetown Accord. So I'm not really dealing with the parallel process in which we reconstitute ourselves. In that process, I assume it is not going to be a process that's left exclusively in the hands of elites. It will be a process with a great deal of public participation in the role that Aboriginal nations have played in our constitutional politics since 1980 makes it clear that they will be important participants in that redefinition of who we, the rest of us outside of Quebec, are. Now, there's another larger question of the role of Aboriginal nations in Quebec, which, in other circumstances, I'd be happy to discuss.
Back there and then over here. We want a question, a quick question.
The question is, one of the ironies in the situation seems to me that if Plan B is what we are stuck with, Quebec leaves and we have to reconstitute, the way in which we reconstitute will probably actually achieve what Plan A had tried to do, namely to create a Canada that would be one in which Quebec would have felt more comfortable had they been here for a bargain.
Question, a comment?
Yeah, the question was that if Quebec leaves and we have to reconstitute, we will probably reconstitute in a way that will make the reconstituted Canada more palatable for the Quebec that has left than we were prepared to do when Quebec was part of us and was threatening to leave. Well, I was at a different conference a little while ago in which someone raised the paradoxical question or observation that given that it seems to be the case that Canadians outside Quebec will accept an independent Quebec nation, assuming there's been a fair question, a reasonable majority, and so on, why, the questioner said at that other conference, are Canadians apparently prepared to accept and to recognize the Quebec nation when they leave Canada, but are unwilling to recognize the Quebec nation within Canada? Sure, it would be better to speed up the process of recognition and advance it so that Quebec stayed rather than left. And this was question was posed as a kind of paradox. I don't think in a sense it is. The reason that those Canadians who are on that side, they recognize Quebec if it leaves as an independent nation, but are unprepared to make a significant national accommodation of Quebec within a Canada that survives as a single country, they act that way because they have a particular vision of the nation state, which makes it difficult for them to think of a significant asymmetrical jurisdiction powered by a separate Quebec nationalism. It just conflicts with their view of what a country should be all about. Now, what you're saying, and I have some agreement with Professor Watkins, who asked the question, is that when we get around to reconstituting, after Quebec has gone, we will probably have to make all kinds of accommodations to our pluralism, which would have been much more sensitive to Quebec had we thought of ourselves in that pluralistic way when Quebec was making the demands on us. Because it does seem to me that Canada without Quebec will have to accommodate the tremendous transformation in the ethnic makeup of this country and the fact that we have 1 million Aboriginal peoples who are asking for a distinct kind of recognition. So it could be that the post Quebec, Canada we create will be more open, more pluralistic, less uniform in one perspective, from that perspective, than the Canada which in a sense has induced Quebecers to vote yes. So I agree it's a paradox if you're then saying maybe Quebec will come in after the fact. I just don't think countries that leave then, you know, re-enter the countries that they have left.
Yes, here.
I've been very struck with historical parallels between India and Canada. Undivided India. When India broke up into Pakistan, Pakistan became two states, West Pakistan and East Bengal. That arrangement continued for a few years, perhaps the waiting period that you have advocated, which I agree with. But I can see the Maritimes falling off the map for very long. There's a land bridge.
What's the question?
Cannot be covered. So do you agree that there is a strong possibility of the Maritimes leaving Canada?
Repeat.
Although the question using the parallel of the breakup of India and then the creation of Pakistan, focused on the Maritimes or the Atlantic provinces and raised the question whether I thought it was possible that those four provinces, I guess we really mean, including Newfoundland, would drift away. In other words, could we overcome the fact that there's a big land block between Atlantic Canada and Ontario? Well, I don't know. That would be one of the big issues on the agenda. Clearly, Atlantic Canada will be petrified at the possibility that it might be cut off from equalization payments, from the bounty that has flowed from the wealthier provinces to the rest of it. There will be some incentive in provinces outside of Atlantic Canada to say maybe the time has come to rethink the sharing which has made Canada the country it is. And so clearly it would be a very difficult situation for Atlantic Canada. I guess my argument would be let's give us time to think out and work through this possibility. Alaska is not contiguous to the United States. We still are knit together by ties of kinship and family. I think one of the important things we underestimate in talking about whether the country will fragment or not is we underestimate the fact that so many of us have aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers, sisters scattered all across the country. And when someone speaks to us as a British Columbian and says we should shed our relationship with those people, W.A.C. Bennett used to say that British Columbia was a goblet to be drained by the rest of Canada. But the answer will be, well, it's some of our people in other parts of the country who are less well off than we are, who are participating in the, they won't say draining the goblet, but getting the benefits of the wealth that happens to be there for us in the wealthier areas. So, clearly that's an extremely difficult problem. I would assume we would try to get a land bridge between Atlantic Canada and Ontario, easy passage of goods and so on. And I don't think it's impossible that we would stay together. I certainly think there'll be minimum incentive in the Atlantic provinces voluntarily to leave. John Crosby has given, very, very pessimistic scenarios of what would happen to Newfoundland if Newfoundland were cut off from Canada after Quebec's departure, and I would agree with that. So I think I would like to try to avoid that.
Yes, Peter?
Alan, would you care to comment on the role of the United States during this positive transition period?
Yeah, my impression, or the question is, would I care to comment on the role of the United States in this transition period? My impression is, of course, that the United States in general would prefer a united Canada. I think if they can't get a united Canada, they would prefer a united rest of Canada. I think their preference would lie in the direction of stability. I don't think that they would have any particular interest in gobbling up parts of Canada outside of Quebec. I don't think Canadians outside of Quebec, unless we reach an absolute cataclysmic situation, themselves have any desire to be annexed by the United States. To be annexed by the United States, you know, changes the distribution of political power in Congress and so on, so it's a major problem for the Americans. And I think the vision of Americans just waiting to gobble us up is quite misconceived. They prefer as much stability as they can get north of their country.
Right back there.
Quebecers almost voted 50% to. It seems to me they voted to offer the rest of Canada some form of different partnership. And I feel as though that's neither Plan A nor Plan B, but something else, something in between, and that this concentrating on Plan A and Plan B is a sort of de facto throwing in the towel.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the question is that the thinking in terms of Plan A and Plan B leaves out the important middle position, which is the partnership that the Parti Québécois did propose in the last referendum. And Mr. Bouchard has indicated, again, he triumphed in last week's Parti Québécois convention in getting that position accepted. The supplementary observation, if I think I heard it correctly, was that we no longer seem to talk about asymmetrical federalism. Well, part of our difficulty goes back to the beginning, and when I said, why are we thinking of Plan B at all? And it is that we have become rather demoralized about the possibility of major constitutional reform within the country, such as asymmetrical federalism. I know it surfaced at some of the public conferences that preceded the Charlottetown Accord. It was fairly widely supported in Halifax at a meeting, at which I was present. On the other hand, you can get a list of statements by provincial premiers which can extend page after page after page that any kind of asymmetrical federalism that implies distinct status for Quebec, which gives them jurisdiction the rest of us don't have, is simply not on. They will say we cannot sell this to our populace, and our populace has to participate because in BC we have a referendum requirement, in Alberta we have a referendum requirement, and therefore in the rest of the country we have a spillover referendum requirement. So the political elite is more or less saying that that kind of internal asymmetry seems to be incapable of being successfully communicated to the citizens so that they will support it. The other issue of partnership after Quebec goes, I guess we don't know now whether a lot of the apparent hostility to the possibility of partnership emanating from politicians outside Quebec is rhetoric to reduce the yes forces, or whether it's the reality that a yes vote in Quebec will encounter. I guess my feeling is that a Quebec yes, particularly if it is the outcome of the kind of campaign we had in the last Quebec referendum, in which the ethnic nationalism of the Quebec majority is whipped to a frenzy of self-identification, and in which the rest of us are portrayed as unsympathetic, as hostile, as the majority in a country which has been completely incapable of responding to Quebec. It seems to me the conjunction of that type of campaign, which is the probable campaign we will get, because the way you get a majority in Quebec is to appeal to the ethnic majority. You're not going to get it by appealing to the Anglophones, the Allophones, and the Aboriginals. They all voted 95 to 99% no in the last referendum. So the incentives in Quebec are to mobilize ethnic nationalists. And that mobilizes them not only against the internal minorities in Quebec, but against the rest of us outside Quebec, and portrays us negatively. In addition to that, it seems to me obvious that we outside of Quebec are going to feel deeply wounded that the country that we wanted to remain together has been taken from us against our will. So I just really don't think there's going to be a set of sentiments immediately available which would allow any major sort of partnership discussions to result in implementation. In addition to which, I've added the difficulty that we can't enter into those sort of finalizing partnership arrangements when we don't know who we are. Until we figure out who the we is, the partnership is not on. So what might happen 10 years, 15 years down the road, I think may be very different from what will happen in the first 5 to 6 or 7 years. I do not see much immediate likelihood of major partnership arrangements with Quebec following a yes referendum. So I don't think that's rhetoric. I think that's a realist interpretation of the world we will live in.
The room is full of questions. We'll take three more. One behind here.
Republic of Quebec, there was more than 50% of MPs in the province of Ontario. How do you think your proposal of a delay of change of constitution for 3 to 5 years is successful? Would you consider not, or would you consider to rethink or reconstitute a new constitution without Quebec in anticipation of Quebec separation in 3 to 5 years or 50 or 100 years later?
Repeat the question.
I think the question was, how would that 3 to 5 year transitional period respond to the reality that in that Canada without Quebec, Ontario will make up approximately 50% of the population, MPs and so on, and that the reconstitution task will have to grapple with that fact. Is that a fair summary of the question? Well, I agree, that's...
Yeah.
Sorry,
my suggestion is that one should think ahead of time instead of at the time of separation. Because if you think about new constitution for 2 years,
yeah. Okay, so the suggestion was that it would be desirable, I guess the suggestion was it would be desirable if we could think about that new constitution without Quebec ahead of time so that we could respond to this very difficult political reality of the overwhelming power of Ontario in that shrunken Canada. Well, I have argued, it can be refuted, but I've argued that it's virtually, for structural reasons, impossible for us outside from academics and think tanks, impossible for us as a people, as citizens and our governments, to seriously confront the reconstitution of Canada prior to it happening. I'm simply saying it won't happen. However desirable it might be, there might be books on your shelves, speeches by academics, there will not be governmental preparation. There may be proposals that academics have put out which will help us thinking about the situation when we get to it. Now in that transitional situation, I guess my hope would be, and this may be a pipe dream I have in my mind, my hope would be that the Ontario MPs and the Ontario government will recognize the extreme fragility of the situation in which they find themselves, and that they would act, that there would be, I would hope, a norm developed of a certain degree of constraint in their utilization of the numerical power that is at their disposal, because they will know that if they act that way, they are jeopardizing not only the possibility of the continuation of the transitional period, but of the possible creation of a single Canada succeeding this transitional period as a result of the thinking we take place in the transitional period. Now, how we in fact respond in our revised constitution to this fact, it's a huge question. One possibility, of course, is the more you decentralize, the less the power of Ontario at the center matters. Another possibility is to have a different kind of electoral system so that we wouldn't get the kind of situation we have now in Ontario, and what is it, I think 98 of the 99 MPs, I mean it's absolutely extraordinary, are Liberals. If we had proportional representation, the partisan power of Ontario in the central legislative body, the House of Commons, would be fragmented, and that might to some extent mute the apprehensions of those of us outside Quebec. However, I would say one of the prime issues in the new constitution process is how do we grapple with this new distribution of regional power in a Canada from which Quebec is gone. And maybe we can't do it. I'm not saying that what I'm proposing will necessarily keep us together. I'm just saying what I'm proposing will give us time to think and to try to work out, so that if there's a good chance we can stay together, which is what I prefer, we will be able to operate on the basis of that chance rather than breaking up prematurely because we've jumped the gun before we had to.
Alan, couldn't you have also responded that because of the dominance of an Ontario, we could ensure our survival and also prevent the breakup of Canada by insisting that in the case of separation, they have to take Toronto?
See, once we all open up the citizen participation, all kind of possibilities.
Two more questions. Yes, Tony here.
One suggestion you haven't mentioned is that of a constituent assembly. Mm-hmm. But some people have suggested that if it were created early, it would deal with the problem that the premiers have not been elected to deal with constitutional matters, but on local issues.
Mm-hmm.
It could also deal with Plan A as well as Plan B.
Mm-hmm.
What is your comment?
Professor Tony Scott asked a very good question that I haven't said anything about a constituent assembly, which some have suggested, he correctly notes, could, leaving aside the practical problems, could at least theoretically be set in place now and could address questions related to both Plan A and Plan B, which governments, for a variety of reasons, can't handle. I guess I would agree that that's probably the only institutional mechanism one can think of in the transitional period that might undertake some preparation of citizens and, you know, various kind of elite groups, possibly even, I don't know, but possibly even with some MLAs from provincial legislative bodies, so that although governments that really can't have a hands-on relationship to this kind of issue, could carry on with the normal business and this other activity could take place. I guess I would say it's one possible way out of my dilemma. Keith Spicer essentially recommended that. The response was interesting. It was a kind of a resounding silence. I guess the difficulty is that we would have as much difficulty getting agreement on the Constitution of the Constituent Assembly, because who is there, in a sense, will influence the outcome, that we'd probably get paralyzed at stage one trying to figure out how to get this thing in operation. But I'm not opposed to that as a possible interim and helpful vehicle to reduce the extent of unpreparedness that I'm otherwise saying would prevail.
Who feels the urgent need to ask the last question? Let me look around the room and see who feels. You have your hand the highest.
First of all, I'd like to see Professor Cairns privately after the talk. But what I wonder...
That's our government.
...is why did we lay down dead after the Meacher Court?
Why did we what? Lay down dead after the Meacher Court?
Because...
Why did we lay down dead? Why did we lie down dead after the Meacher Court? Oh.
Because what... If Quebec said Canada reject... The rest of Canada rejected Quebec at that time. When, in fact... At least seven of the jurisdictions approved Meech, and in Manitoba it died on a technicality, and you know what happened in Newfoundland.
Yeah.
We just accepted it without a comeback.
Yeah.
We rejected Quebec at that time.
Yeah. This is a question from someone I thought before we asked it was my friend. The question was, why did we lay down, I believe was the phrase used by the questioner, after Meech Lake, and I guess accept the Quebec interpretation of that as a rejection, when in fact, seven of the nine provinces outside Quebec had accepted it, and Newfoundland actually had passed legislation and it had been rescinded. By the subsequent government. Why, the questioner is saying, did we not make that point crystal clear to Quebecers? It wasn't rejection, because if you think in terms of political units, it was pretty well close to a success. And had we not had the adopted the foolish practice of packaging the whole of the Meech Lake proposals into a unanimity requirement, I think about three of the five of them could have been implemented, because seven provinces with 50% of the population would have been enough to pass it. Well, there are two observations. One, it's true that at one level, at the end had gotten through seven of the nine, and earlier had gotten through Newfoundland, and which had been rescinded. The other reality is that by the end of the Meech Lake process, the polls were crystal clear that, subject to faulty memory, something like 80% of Canadians were opposed to the Meech Lake package. So although the governments remained in favor, had they gone back to their people and asked for referendum support, they wouldn't have gotten it. So even had it passed, in a sense, it would have been a hollow victory.